honestly, once I realized that there was more than one option, I've never been happier. And it's just, and when people use my pronouns, it's just like that euphoric, right? And so it's just, it's one of those things that I just had kind of decided that I was never going to be able to feel this way, that I was just always, and it's kind of, it was like filling a hole that inside of myself that I didn't know existed.
Yeah.
And honestly, I'm so grateful, even though it took 35 years, I'm so grateful that I had the language eventually, and that I was able to come out when I did.
You're listening to MB Teachers Unplugged, the official podcast of the Manitoba Teachers Society.
Welcome, my beloved members, to episode 5 of the MB Teachers Unplugged podcast, the official podcast of the Manitoba Teachers Society. I'm your host, Zach Schnitzer, he, him, and I'm a staff officer with Society in the Professional and French Language Services Department, where I aim to educate, promote, and support teacher well-being for you, the 16,000-plus hardworking educators, members of MTS. As always, thank you so very much for listening. We hope you're listening to this well. Maybe you're doing something at work, cleaning up or photocopying or marking even, or maybe you're commuting or engaged in a self-care activity. That's kind of why we're doing the podcast. We don't want to ask anything more. And remember, though, I will ask something more, to subscribe on your favorite podcast apps and tell all your friends about us. So today, episode 5, I'm excited to talk with Marley Dewar, they, them, about the realities of teaching when you were part of the 2STLGBTQIA+ community. I'm using that acronym based on the recommendations for equity document created by MTS's ad hoc committee in March 2022. And I'd like to thank my colleague Sarah Gazan and the members of that committee who put that together. Marley identifies as gender non-binary and teaches grade 6 at Hartney School in the Southwest Horizon School Division near Brandon. And they have a lot to say. I can't wait for you to hear it. Before we get to that, let's get to our land acknowledgement. As is customary before each of our meetings at the Manitoba Teachers Society, we recognize our history as a settler organization on these lands. McMaster House and Bradley Square are located on Treaty 1 lands, the original lands of the Anishinaabe, Aninawak, Anishinaabeg, Dakota, and Dene peoples, and on the homeland of the Métis Nation. The Manitoba Teachers Society respects the treaties that were made on these territories. We acknowledge the harms and mistakes of the past and present, and we dedicate ourselves to move forward in partnership with the Indigenous communities in a spirit of reconciliation and collaboration. And class is in session, folks, so the bell's about to ring. And remember, whenever the bell rings, between segments here on the pod or in your school, I invite you to use it as an opportunity to take a nice deep breath in through your nose, filling up your belly, and slowly out through your mouth. Okay, Marley, thanks for joining MB Teachers Unplugged today. I'm thrilled we can do this in person, even though you teach in the Brandon area. Marley, how are you doing today?
I'm doing great. I'm happy to be here, and I'm really honored to be a part of this podcast.
Well, you came with high regards from my colleague, Terry Lynn Hill, who I'm a big fan of. And so if Terry recommended you, I was like, okay, we're getting Marley. So before we get into the teacher stuff, tell us a bit about you personally and professionally, and maybe even one thing you do for your own wellness, because we are talking about wellness all the time.
So I work out in Hartney, and yeah. I'm from actually Winnipeg, and I grew up in the north end of Winnipeg. And when I met my wife, she's a teacher. She teaches in Brandon, and I saw a job opportunity in Wawanisa, which, you know, is about 30 minutes away, and decided to jump at it. And ever since then, I have been teaching rurally and absolutely love it, even though that's not something I ever thought I would say growing up in Winnipeg, doing my schooling in Winnipeg, and even starting my career out here in Winnipeg. But I've been teaching middle years for a majority of my career, mainly grade 7 and 8. But this year I'm teaching grade 6, which I'm thoroughly enjoying. For my own wellness, a lot of people we see, like, you know, yoga, walks and stuff like that. Honestly, for me, it's video games. I've always loved video games, and I've just in the last few years have decided to lean into it. And I just enjoyed the storylines for a lot of them and just to kind of escape reality for a little bit. Yeah. But I also just love the challenges. Like I play games that, you know, you have to think and, you know, and, yeah. and often solve different kind of problems or your actions do create, you know, consequences later on. And so it's a lot of fun and it's a great way to kind of escape. And I've got a 3-year-old son now. And so he's started to play some of these games with me as well. And so it's a lot of fun and something that we can enjoy together.
And what's the favorite game right now?
Oh, right now, I really enjoy Dragon Quest. I actually just got a tattoo with it, and that's the game that I play with my son. Oh, cool. He's able to control the main character, but so am I. So, you know, if he starts veering off into a group of monsters we cannot fight, yeah. I just can redirect him. And one of my all-time favorite games is Dragon Age, and it's a fantasy type world where your actions don't only affect the game you're playing, but it also affects the world state in the second and in the third game, and they're about to come out with the fourth. Oh, wow. Plus there is, you can be gender, sexuality is all very fluid in the game. And in the last game they had trans characters. Cool. And so it's a wonderful game. It's not for children. But
so your 3-year-old doesn't play with this?
No, that one is just for myself. It's been a game I've been playing for the last 15 years, and cool. I just discovered they had books, so now I'm reading the books and kind of fully diving in.
But I think for educators, when I used to work in EAP, and just talking to members now, you have such a mentally and emotionally taxing job that if you don't redirect your energy for self-care, like in something that is really requires a lot of your attention, it just sort of takes over. It just becomes your default to be thinking about school.
Oh, for sure. And I think that's what I was finding, especially before, like I had my son in 2019. So I came back from mat leave in April 2020. So I don't really know. There was the pre-COVID teaching, but also like pre-child teaching too. Right. And now like with COVID and having my son at home, I've tried to make a more of a point to have those moments where I spend time doing things that I enjoy.
Yeah.
Just to kind of, as you say, like shut my brain off, just kind of immerse myself into something that has nothing to do with education and just something for complete enjoyment.
Yeah.
And so it's one of the things that I make sure that I give myself time to do every week.
Good for you. And I love it because a lot of people won't think of video games because maybe they have like a bad reputation, but it's like, I totally get why video games are a great escape. I mean, because they're totally immersive, right? And so I want to ask you, before we get into sort of your identity and the 2S TLGBTQIA+ sort of identity stuff and what that's like, you are a teacher. And so what is it like being a teacher now in January 2023?
It's really strange because I feel like I exist in multiple worlds. One world, you know, being where everybody assumes that we are now in a post-COVID, post-pandemic reality. Everything's back to normal, you know, that schools are reopened. And then there's the other reality, which is what's actually going on in the classroom, where students are struggling, teachers are struggling, mental health is at an all-time low. And we see this especially in our students as they're acting out more, they might be talking back more, they are not able to necessarily process things at the same speed as they have been before. And I think a lot of it has to come down to is the fact of, you know, the idea that we have had to make things normal, but we haven't actually addressed any of the long-term effects of the isolation that kids felt, the fact that they've missed out on life events, like graduation, you know, whether it's you're talking about students who are in the younger years, teaching grade 6, I've realized that the last time my students had a normal school year was actually in grade 2. And so even socially and emotionally, they are not 11-year-olds as they were, you know, pre-COVID, because they've spent a majority of their like childhood in kind of a fight or flight kind of stance where, mm-hmm. you know, on one hand, they're being told a lot about the pandemic and other things that are going on in the world. And then on the other hand, we are kind of pushing forward like none of this is actually happening. And so they are struggling with comprehending a lot of that. And you put in hormones and all of the other emotions.
Right,
into
in the middle
it.
School context, yeah. right? You're just, behind yeah. and yet you have all the hormones too.
Exactly. And so it's just, it's one of those things where, you know, you kind of have to take a step back. You know, curriculum is important, absolutely. But sometimes just making sure that your students are, you know, here at the end of the year, that's sometimes been my focus. And so because the other things can be taught, can be caught up, but the mental health of our students has to come first. And so I find that just plugging forward without addressing it has become detrimental not only to our students, but for teachers as well, yeah. who know what they should be doing, but are sometimes constricted on what they can do because of deadlines and outcomes yeah. and everything else that that we have to do.
Yeah, I love the way you put that. And it's almost like you're speaking to something that I've heard a lot of, Marley, which is the first year after quote unquote COVID ended, it was really, you know, get them back into school, let's normalize school again, pressure's off. And then it became very quickly like, okay, now you have to get them caught up. And it's like, wait, what?
I find like we are still talking about the fact that we somehow can go back to 2019 and, you know, the pre-pandemic. And I with my students, I draw the parallels with 9/11 when we were kids, because there was a direct shift in the universe at that point. There was the before and then there was the after. And the context of what the world that we were living in changed on that day. Mm-hmm. And so with the pandemic, that's exactly what happened. There was the before and now we're in the after, but we're still trying to hang on to the before rather than meeting the challenges with what we know about today and adjusting our expectations based on that. And so, and because of that, and I hear this from a lot of teachers and colleagues as well, is just kind of wanting to take that step back in order to really address the needs that are being shown to us. But again, you know, it's one of the, you know, trying to get kids caught up and moving on, keeping things normal. And so it's just we straddling kind of that line, trying to do what's best for your students, but also making sure that we are doing what is required for us because of our job.
Yeah, it doesn't sound easy. I feel myself cringing even as you say that, Marley, and I appreciate you speaking to that. So I asked you to come on, and I asked Terry Lynn Hill, for someone who was in the 2STLGBTQIA+ community. And I'm thinking, like, on the one hand, I really appreciate you saying yes, but on the other hand, I had worried that, like, does it put a lot of pressure on you to like, is it like you have to speak to this all the time because you're open about being trans non-binary?
I think, like, there's two aspects of it. You know, I'm always going to be honored when Terry thinks of me, because I also think the world of Terry, and
we all do.
You know, yeah. But on the other hand, I never thought that this was going to be who I was. I didn't come out as non-binary until June or July of 2020.
And oh, really? So it's quite recent.
It's quite recent. And it really took a lot of the pandemic and self-reflecting and just almost realizing my, you know, why things never really seemed to fit. And it's because I was trying to fit myself into a context that I don't belong. And so once I started kind of looking at things differently, it just all seemed to sort of click. Mm-hmm. And it's since then I have seen a change in my own confidence, my ability, who I am. And but I also feel an immense responsibility because I teach in an area where it's not necessarily easy to be openly queer, but openly queer and trans at the same time, trans non-binary. You know, before I came out as non-binary, I experienced very little homophobia within the classroom. But since coming out as non-binary, you know, it does seep in different little ways. And so, but then I just kind of think about my students and those who might be queer or might be trans, and what it means to have somebody like myself in the classroom normalizing, because I am who I am. I don't try to hide it. You know, it's and normalizing these identities. And so I think the more exposure, especially in rural areas where there is less exposure to different types of identities, the better it is for our students.
Right.
And the better it is for communities as well, because often a lot of ignorance comes out of just not knowing or not being exposed to. And so while it can be very exhausting kind of taking on this role and mentally taxing, it is something that is very dear to me and is something that does keep me driving, because it's almost like healing myself, where, you know, I just kind of imagine what it would be like if, you know, I was 12 and then had somebody like myself in the classroom and, you know, wondering about, you know, would it have taken me 35 years to kind of figure that out, right. You know? And so it's just, it's nice. And it's difficult, but I feel an immense responsibility just to kind of be that face, because I also do hold a lot of privilege within the community. Mm. I am white and queer, white and non-binary. And so I am able to kind of be in those spaces, right? But I don't necessarily face all of the same things that are, you know, Black, Indigenous, and other people of color face in the classroom on top of their queer or trans identities.
Yes.
And so I just find that with my privilege, it almost comes with that responsibility in order to take up space, but also find ways to create space for people who might not have the same type of privilege that I enjoy.
It's beautiful, and it's that there's an immense responsibility there that you take on, which I think is so gracious, but it also heals you. I could see that. But then my heart breaks for those 35 years of where things just didn't click for you. And then I think, you know, if young Marley had had someone like, you know, old adult Marley now, and I'll read a stat for you. This came out of Instagram from a podcast called the Unbiased Science Podcast, and our executive director Danielle Fullen Colton pointed me to this. And what it said was, in the States, 40% of 2SLGBTQIA+ that had one supportive adult were 40% less likely to attempt suicide.
Yeah.
And so it makes me think about that what you're doing now is life-saving, Marley.
And I can only hope. Not everybody I have been friends with have made it to adulthood, because they, you know, it's just been very, it was very difficult. Mm-hmm. You know, and I have lost friends to suicide.
Yeah.
And it's just, when I think about the stats for queer youth and just like how simple it can be to like avoid. So, you know, one supportive adult, giving people, calling people by their chosen names, right? Not dead naming students, using their proper pronouns. Like it's very, very simple. Mm-hmm. And these are all easily things that we can do, yet for some reason seems to still be a struggle within our system. Especially because, you know, students might be out at school, but it might not be safe for them at home. And so they kind of straddle those two worlds themselves. And so it's kind of, we have to decide like our responsibility, is it to the student or to the parent, and what is best for them. And so, you know, just what I tell my students every day is just talking about, you know, names are important, you know, pronouns are important, our identity is important. And so I try to focus on that and, you know, and kind of talking about that as well. But because, you know, these stats exist and, you know, there's been like the still in every school. So there was the every school in every classroom that was done about 10 years ago. And it was a study on homophobia and transphobia within schools. And you still see the stats of like, and again, 2/3 who have experienced homophobia or transphobia within the school system.
Yeah.
And so at this point, sometimes even taking up space and refusing to back down and refusing to remove yourself. So it would be easy for me to, I guess, leave and go to a area where, you know, you don't see as many homophobic or transphobic comments, but at the same time, that's not going to change anything. And at the end of the day, I love it out there. Like, it's, I love the students, I love my colleagues. It's a great place to work. And really, we sometimes have this idea that like coming into Winnipeg is better, but it's everywhere. If whether you're rural, whether you're in metro, whether, you know, you're in up north, this exists everywhere. And so I think we need to be in as many spaces as possible, just so people don't forget that we do exist.
Absolutely. And, you know, and one of the reasons I wanted to get you on the podcast is another stat I saw from the States is that 89% of folks who saw two STLGBTQIA plus represented in the media said it made them feel better about their identity. And here you are in the media, too. So you're taking on a lot here for us, Marley.
And, no, and it's and I can attest to that because I grew up with like little to no representation. I mean, our representation growing up would be like Xena warrior princess, you know, that was always hinted at, but like never actually explicitly said. And it really wasn't until I was in my 20s that you started to see characters who were not necessarily trans, but gay, lesbian on different shows that weren't there just to kind of support the straightness of the other characters. And so, and then I just discovered a new genre of books of like sapphic, which is basically women, women dating women, or non-binary, where they have, there's fantasy, there's romance, there's, you know, all of this out there. And I've been consuming as much of it as I possibly can because for years, this didn't exist. And so it's just that little representation, even as an adult, is just wonderful.
Well, and you think about like, if I'm a youth and I don't see myself represented as an adult in mainstream media, then maybe I don't belong. And then that suicide thing comes. I mean, I know that's heavy, but let me just backtrack a little bit. And this may seem like a silly, simple question, but it's, I think it's an important one. So you identify as trans, non-binary. And so for folks who might be unfamiliar with what that means, is it okay if I ask you, like, what exactly does that mean for you, Marley?
So the thing I've learned about trans non-binary is it kind of, it's very personal for everybody. And so what it means for me might be very different for other people. And so for me, it's, the way I try to describe it is kind of growing up, I never really felt like anything fit. And so it was, I tried wearing dresses. It goes more than clothes, right? Like, but I tried wearing dresses. I tried different hairstyles. Remember in grade seven, somebody once told me that I would make a really cute boy. So then for a while, you know, I thought about what it would like to be a boy, but then, you know, not knowing that I wasn't. And it's just like, and so it was very confusing. And when I realized that there's more than two options out there, like boy or girl, male or female, I started to kind of explore what that meant. And I remember hearing the term mixed. So I go by mixed doer, which is MX. And in the classroom, I hated my name. I hated every time somebody said Miss Doer. And I couldn't pinpoint why. And so after coming out and then changing my honorific to mix, that same feeling that I, when I heard people saying my name, dissipated. The same thing is just, the terms boy and girl are just too simplistic, where like, I would consider myself both and neither, right? It's just, it's not necessarily that I consider that I'm like both a boy and a girl, but I really just don't feel like either really describes who I am. And so obviously growing up and being socialized for so long as a woman, you know, there are those things that, and I was assigned female at birth. So those are those things that stick with me. But honestly, once I realized that there was more than one option, I've never been happier. And it's just, and when people use my pronouns, it's just like that euphoric, right? And so it's just, it's one of those things that, I just had kind of decided that I was never going to be able to feel this way, that I was just always, and it's kind of, it was like filling a hole that inside of myself that I didn't know existed. And honestly, I am so grateful, even though it took 35 years, I'm so grateful that I had the language eventually, and that I was able to come out when I did. And what makes me happy is that kids aren't going to have that language nowadays. And so kids are going to be able to come out earlier because they are seeing more representation. There are people who are, you know, we have politicians, we have teachers, we have leaders, and even celebrities now who are openly out. And so the language is now there for everybody. And I think that's a really special thing. And it's just that I'm hoping that most people don't have to wait so long to discover who they are. But at the same time, I know that I'm from a generation where it does take a little bit longer because we didn't talk about it. And so in our ideas of what we understood, what non-binary meant, I didn't think that that was something that I could fit myself into, but then realizing that it's not a monolith. There isn't one way to be non-binary, and that's the whole kind of purpose of it, is the fact that you don't have to be both either or. You can just be who you are. And now I feel like I've been more authentically myself in the last couple of years than I ever was before that.
Well, and it's beautifully said. Not that you need me to say that, but I just keep, you know, what you're saying is really touching to me. And it reminds me of one definition of mental illness that I really like, is that mental illness is when you've had to be someone else for too long. And I think that just fits with what you're saying, right? Like, if you can't be yourself, then how can you be well?
And I think that, like, goes beyond just, you know, being trans, non-binary, queer. You know, just thinking and about my son who, you know, loves, he has grown up half on the farm with his grandparents, which is very different from my city upbringing. But, you know, he loves his tractors. He has started to play, you know, hunting. He loves going fishing. He loves all of that. But his favorite colors are pink and purple, and he loves sparkles and, you know, and all of these other different things. And I think, quite honestly, just allowing our children and our students to be who they are unapologetically, we're going to see a lot more of that. And so it's allowing kids or people in general just to be who they are, express themselves in the way that they want to. All of a sudden, we are going to allow people to become adults who are more confident in who they are. But in my view, and take it with a grain of salt, but like with less maybe mental health issues, because they've never had to suppress or hide or feel shame for anything that they like or their interests, just because it doesn't fit into our, you know, binary kind of thinking about boys and girls.
Yeah, I'll take it with a grain of salt. I'll take it with several grains of salt because I think there's a lot there.
So you talk about mix and you talk about pronouns, and your pronouns are they, them. We talked about that. And it's making me reflect right now, Marley, how crucial these pronouns are. Like, what I've taken so far, one of the things anyway, is that pronouns can be life-saving and the words matter. And so I've heard some people say, I get why people who are non-binary or trans need different pronouns. It makes sense. But why do I have to, like, as a cisgender heterosexual male or female, why do I have to use the pronouns? Can't we just assume that I am not trans or non-binary because I'm not using pronouns? And I was curious about what you thought of that.
The whole pronoun debate is really fascinating because people are acting as if pronouns haven't existed since the beginning of time, like, or the English language. We've used pronouns, you know, I'm guessing for since the beginning of the English language, right? It's a way so we're not repeating the noun over and over again. But now, for some reason, pronouns are specifically tied to trans and non-binary folk. And so you see, I heard a story of a teacher teaching just pronouns in the classroom, as you do when you're teaching parts of speech, and parents then calling and accusing them of teaching something that is, you know, part of the liberal agenda or, you know, different things like that.
Being overly woke.
Exactly. Which is, I will never get, because it's not bad to be anti-racist or not homophobic or not transphobic.
Oh, you're so woke. You mean I'm actually trying to help people and save lives? So, okay, sure.
I don't know how that turned into an insult, but it's kind of not the point. But no, I think the biggest thing for me, and how I explained it, because I get misgendered and that's going to happen. And, you know, the only thing that I ask is that people try, right? And so, you know, if I know that people are deliberately misgendering or just not even seeming to kind of try about it, then that I kind of start thinking about whether or not that's intentional. However, mm-hmm. most of the time, you know, especially with people I have known for, let's say, 30 years, and they've used one pronoun, it takes time to adjust.
Right.
And so, I mean, the things that I think are just, if you find yourself misgendering, just either correct yourself and move on. I know a lot of the time we want to apologize so the other person doesn't, you know that we weren't trying to do that. But at the same time, I never really understood this until I came out, but I get that a lot. And sometimes it feels like I'm comforting other people about right. my pronouns.
Right.
And it's a weird feeling.
Yeah.
And so.
So maybe don't apologize because well, it just yeah, adds extra yeah. emotional labor.
Exactly. And so it's just like, just, you know, kind of think about it and then just correct yourself.
Yeah.
And then just keep trying. And just yeah. sometimes it does just take practicing when you're talking about the person. My students are great. They try so hard, but again, I get misgendered and that's fine. And when I talked to them about it and I told them that I was going to gently remind them or correct them and not to take it in a way where like they've done something wrong or anything like that. And just, I talked about the importance of just trying to remember my pronouns in the same way that if I started misgendering them all the time. Mm-hmm. And so if I started, calling somebody who, you know, goes by he, him, she, her, and, you know, how they would feel about that if I was constantly kind of undermining their identity on purpose.
Yeah.
And we really, what I often find is you have to make that connection in order, that personal connection, to make people kind of really think about it and kind of empathize about what it's actually like. Mm-hmm. And so for the people who say, why do I have to use them? Well, we use pronouns all the time, right? You use pronouns. I'm just not going to assume yeah. because I know that trans people are not a monolith and we come in all different, you know, shapes, sizes, expression. And, you know, just because somebody might be expressing themselves in a feminine way does not mean that they necessarily are assigned female at birth doesn't necessarily mean that they are, you know, that they aren't non-binary. So, right. you know, it's as simple as just asking people's pronouns. And it's just,
and so can you do that? I'm like, you're the arbiter of everything that's right and wrong, Marley, no pressure. Am I allowed to do that? Like to yeah. say, hi, I'm Zach, he, him.
Yeah.
Like I imagine that would be in an ideal world. Yeah. Everyone introduces themselves with yeah. their pronoun.
Yeah. And so that's exactly like kind of it. Right. And it's just like, and it's even better when non-trans people do it because yeah. it's really awkward always being the person as the trans person coming right. in and reminding people of our pronouns.
Right.
And you know, it's just, again, like anybody who's in an equity seeking or equity deserving group, you know, it's not up to people who experience racism to fight racism.
Yeah.
It's yeah. up to all of us who don't experience it to fight it for them because, right. They experience it daily. They don't need,
yeah.
you know, and so they don't, and it's the same thing I'm finding, you know, the same thing with homophobia and transphobia. It's just like, I find often, you know, I am the person who's experiencing it and then also fighting it. And it can be a very yeah. lonely experience. Yeah. So funnily enough, one of the things that reminds me of is even before I was out as non-binary and going back to when I was like 20 and, or 19 even, and I was getting ready to do a program called Canada World Youth. And it's an exchange program. And my program was between Nova Scotia and Cuba. And so just before we were getting ready to go out and meet everybody, we kind of connected over, and I'm dating myself now, MSN Messenger. And
I remember MSN Messenger.
And so what happened is that I was newly out. I think I'd only been out for about like maybe 6 months at this point.
And not as non-binary.
No, as a lesbian.
As a lesbian.
Yeah. And so, and I remember talking to somebody and they asked me if I was leaving, you know, anybody special behind, and they had used male pronouns. And then within a brief second, they then sent another message saying, oh, I'm so sorry. I did not mean to assume that you date men. You know, it's and just kind of then corrected themselves. And I, for the first time, and again, I'd only been out for 6 months, I had felt seen. And that is not the norm. The norm is everybody assumes I'm a, well, if you are not aware of, you know, queer dress and haircuts and things like that, people might assume that I'm a cisgendered, you know, heterosexual woman. Going, it's more so when I had my longer hair. With my shorter hair, people are not as surprised. It using our pronouns, not assuming who we are, just helps us feel seen. And it reminds us that we have a place in this world, because quite often we are told that we do not belong here. You know, there is no room for us here. We can exist as long as it doesn't make anything more difficult for other people, as long as people's religious rights, you know, sometimes comes before our rights to exist. And so often those little things, like using somebody's name and pronoun, basically just lets us know that we're here, we belong, and we have a place in this world. And so I think that's one of the biggest things going forward, is just the fact that, you know, even with the NHL, with the what happened in Philadelphia, if there is no repercussions from the NHL as a whole, what they're showing is, again, somebody's religious freedoms supersedes our right to exist, our right to be who we are. And it's just that one little reminder of we've come far, but we still have a lot further to go.
We do. And I want to get to an article that came out in the Free Press about North Dakota. Because, I mean, you're talking about pronouns can be microaggressions. This is macroaggressions. This is like fascism, in my opinion. But I don't want to apologize, because that puts the labor onto you. But I wish I could go back on our first initial phone conversation and say, hi, I'm Zach Schnitzer, he, him. And I think what I'm taking away is, at the very least, that's what we can do. When we are introduced to anybody, verbally or in written form, use your pronouns. Because then there's someone who's non-binary who feels seen. Just before we get to the North Dakota thing, because that article in the Free Press like just made me horrified. In terms of allyship, if I am binary, if I am cisgender, as a colleague of yours, or as a student, or as a maybe someone who's in a supervisory role, is there anything else we can do to make it safe for folks who are gender non-binary?
I think the biggest thing, because allyship always comes up, and I think about my own role as an ally, because again, I come from a very privileged space. And allyship to me, we often use it as a noun, like I am an ally, but allyship is not a noun. And I don't really feel like it's something that we can bestow upon ourselves, but it's something that we strive to be, because we are going to make mistakes. And the best thing that we can do is learn, right? And so no need to apologize for not doing that, because we don't know until we know, right? And so it's kind of what we do with that information then going forward. And so for me, allyship is not about being perfect or anything like that. It's about striving to be better. And it's not just, you know, showing up to the, let's say, the pride parades, and, you know, and putting up a sticker and, you know, a safe space. But it comes when the difficult conversations come up in, you know, in the classrooms or in the hallways or with the community members. And quite often, people from the queer community are then turned to deal with what's going on within the community regarding transphobia and homophobia, which again puts that labor back on us. And so I think really just kind of showing up even when it's hard, having the difficult conversations even when it's hard, right? Because I think what sometimes we forget, and again, you know, just from my experience as well, is just like, I can go home and not think about things that, you know, don't necessarily affect me in my day-to-day life. And it's really easy to, you know, lock that away. But the people who are experiencing these harms don't get to do that. You know, I don't get to turn my identity off and who I am and my family and any of that. And that is my existence. And so sometimes it feels with people, you know, we proclaim ourselves allies, but like when it comes to those moments where you really have to prove your allyship, it's uncomfortable. Mm-hmm. And so we don't necessarily push ourselves forward. Right. So I think the biggest thing is, you know, educate yourself, you know, reading books, watching media that have a diverse of voices. Again, also making sure that because really queerness has been seen through a white lens for so long. And so even just, you know, thinking about a show recently, A League of Their Own, which was recreated on Prime Video.
I love that movie growing up.
Oh, I loved it too. The show's way better. Very queer and very true to...
Still with Charlie Sheen?
Yeah. No.
I didn't think so.
No. but it was done... But they also included queer Black voices and narratives in the story, which are often even less seen.
Right.
And so I think the biggest thing is making sure that we're not taking up too much space as allies, mm-hmm. right? B, making sure that we are showing up when we are needed. We're stepping aside when we are not needed. And just really listening to the experiences of people from these groups. And then just once we know better, we do better.
And I want to pick up on discomfort, because the story I told myself when you were saying discomfort is, if I don't know what gender non-binary is, or I don't know what your pronouns are, it's uncomfortable for me to put myself out there and ask.
Yeah.
Or make a mistake. Is that what you mean by discomfort? Or is it
sort
broader?
Sort of, or just like, going to use just, I guess, an example from my own life. A few years ago, I said something not realizing kind of the racial background of it. Mm-hmm. And I was called out on it. Mm-hmm. And so the first reaction sometimes that we have on the inside is just like, well, I'm not, you know, racist, and I'm not this and I'm not that. But rather than like really kind of taking a back second to kind of think about that, right?
Yeah.
So when I think about this, I often think of Dr. Kevin Kumashiro, who I've had the pleasure of hear speak at the recent Queer and Trans Symposium here in Winnipeg that was put on by MTS mm-hmm. in the University of Manitoba. But he talks about discomfort in learning, right? And so discomfort is kind of the places where we learn and where we grow. And so we feel discomfort because we do things in our intention is not to hurt anybody or anything that, but our impact mm-hmm. is different. And usually what I do is I talk about intent versus impact. You know, if I spilled a bottle of water, right? Obviously, I probably didn't mean to spill it, but I still have to clean it up. Mm-hmm. It, no matter if I intended to do it or not, there is still a mess. I still have to clean it up, and I still have to I have to deal with the outcomes of that.
Right.
And so when we are called out for, you know, things that we may not have realized are racist, sexist, homophobic, transphobic, or any of those other things, as allies, it's our job not to fight back or to double down, but it's right. our job to listen and, you know, journal some of our feelings.
Yeah.
But then really kind of come to where that came from. And do that introspection and that healing, because we have grown up in a world where none of us are unbiased. We have grown up with messages right from when we were kids into the adulthood. And so we have a lot of unlearning to do. Mm-hmm. And that is our responsibility, because really until we do a lot of the unlearning that we need to do and the healing that we need to do, we're not really going to be able to show up in ways that are authentic and helpful. And also the doubling down then puts the onus again, and that apologies and all of that puts the onus back onto the person who's experiencing these like racism, sexism and all of that. And so that's where kind of when I look at allyship, that's the biggest thing, and is just how can I be better? And just kind of always learning. And again, it's not something that I think I am. It's something that I'm doing or I'm trying to be. Mm-hmm. And also understanding that I'm going to make mistakes, and it is my responsibility when I make a mistake or when I do things that unintentionally to then learn and do better and then, you know, help others, you know, kind of come to that. And that's really, it's something I can do naturally, but it's not something that is easy for most people. And so, but it's at that, and Dr. Kevin Kumashiro talks about like that, in that discomfort is when the most growth happens and when learning actually happens. And so it's really important to kind of sit in that and just kind of in learning from it and reflecting on it and, you know, and kind of understanding. And I have a background in history. And so when we look back at Canadian history and just even now teaching it at the grade six level and knowing what I know now versus what I was taught, you know, it's very different. Yeah. And we need to start talking about the truth of things and, and rather than glossing over, a lot of different people, you know, and just focusing on one perspective, we really have to start, you know, this is where our roles as teachers start bringing in the different perspectives in the classroom. So if we're talking about history and Canadian histories specifically, we have to bring in the Indigenous voice. We have to bring in the Black voice. We have to bring in the Asian voices because there's lots of European voices within our history, but we kind of glide over a lot of the other people who are a fundamental part of who we are as as a nation.
Very well said. And I think that discomfort piece, I think a lot of us might double down and become defensive because we're ashamed. It's almost like, oh my goodness, I'm homophobic now, so I have to reject that. And then it puts the onus on you. And I think one thing I'm taking away is like, when I get called out, and hopefully I get called out in a constructive way, you know, like the behavior, not the person kind of thing, like hard on the message, not the messenger. I think we have to be, what I'm taking is, we have to be very keenly aware of how we're reacting and the language we're using on ourselves. So if I'm interpreting that as, oh, this person just called me homophobic, well, then I'm going to get defensive. But if I say, oh, this person just gave me an opportunity to learn, then I'm not going to feel as ashamed. I can feel guilty. But there's more movement with guilt, right? Than shame is like, I'm bad. So then I'm going to get defensive.
And I think, and building upon that too, is we are not always going to be called out in ways that are comfortable for us. Mm-hmm. Because again, the capacity of the person who's experiencing it might be very different. And so, you know, whether, obviously I've learned the more constructive and, you know, talking about the behavior rather than the person and things like that, that's kind of how I lead. But through TikTok and doing a lot of following a lot of
TikTok is legit.
Okay? I know. I learned a lot from it. And especially with, I follow a lot of anti-racist creators, and kind of one of the biggest things is, we talk about tone policing. And so, you know, it's, if a person, let's say, is calling somebody out, from whether it's microaggression, macroaggression, because really with microaggressions, reading How to Be an Anti-Racist, Ibram X. Kendi, he talks about like the fact that microaggressions are aggressions, right? Because, you know, if, when you receive 1,000 microaggressions a day, they don't feel micro, like, because you're taking the message in all the time. So, you know, we call them sometimes covert or overt. And I think the biggest thing is kind of realizing that we are all racist. We are all, like, because we grew up in a white supremacist patriarchal society. So we are not going to be free from that. So, you know, kind of understanding that that's where our frame kind of begins and accepting that, then we can kind of start to deal with a lot of that.
And de-shaming it in a way, just saying we're all this way.
Exactly. And so, like, and then that. Understanding and then actively trying to undo that, right? And so, while it might make me uncomfortable and very angry if, you know, somebody is calling me out on it in a way that maybe I don't feel comfortable with, I have to kind of, it's kind of my responsibility to take a second to kind of think about why their reaction might be the way that it is. And it's not up to me to basically tell them how to tell me not to do things, but also it's still up to me to kind of deal with it. And that's, I think, one of the hardest parts, is because we want people to tell us in a nice way. But there's sometimes no nice way to say them. And maybe your comment was like the 100th comment that they've gotten.
Well, that's what I was going to say. Yeah. Like, sorry to cut you off, but I cut people off all the time. White male cisgender guy cutting. I just want to say though, like that I actually learned something right now is that if someone says it to me in a way that makes me feel ashamed, that's not necessarily their fault, because maybe I'm the 100th person that day that gave them a microaggression by using the wrong pronoun or whatever it is. And it's like, should it be up to that person to be all, you know, like friendly and nice about it? I'm not so sure. I don't think so.
No, and that, I've learned a lot of that from, honestly, from Black creators on TikTok. And just like, because a lot of the time, you know, there are some creators who specifically watch how they speak and how they say their message so that they don't get a lot, like the comments of, you know, just another, you're yelling at me. And, you know, if maybe if you said it a little bit nicer, I would be more willing to not be racist or not be homophobic.
That's gaslighting, isn't it?
Yeah, it's just like, exactly. And so I think when we understand that it's our responsibility to kind of do that healing and to kind of take that calling out, however comfortable or uncomfortable it is, and to do better, then I think we're getting into a more constructive kind of way, because then it's still not about the person, right? It's still about the behavior, but not all of us. And I used to be somebody who didn't understand why my friends maybe didn't want to go out because of there was no bathroom option. And, you know, honestly, I used to be transphobic a lot myself. And because I came from a place of really just ignorance and not understanding. And when I had people, you know, kind of call me out on it, I didn't always necessarily react in the best way either. And really now understanding what, you know, they were going through and things like that, I now have a better kind of picture of it. And it's just, again, it's not my job to be tell them how to give the message. Right. It's my job to take the message and to grow from that.
Yeah.
And that's really what being anti-racist, anti-oppressive is about. Yeah. It's not about, you know, never saying anything or never doing anything, but it's about that accountability piece and constantly striving to be better.
And we have you even talk about your own privilege. I have like the ultimate privilege. My colleague Sherry Jones says the world is my affinity space, which I thought was one of the best comments ever. But, you know, we have the privilege to be uncomfortable. We have the privilege to withstand that being uncomfortable. You said you keep sort of being self-deprecating about TikTok, but like here I am. Some of my great stats from our executive director, Danielle Fullen-Colton, are from Instagram. And it was a post by, what was the podcast name again? Oh, Unbiased Science Podcast out of the States. The last statistic I want to say was that 70% of trans non-binary teens have lower odds of suicidality if they're provided access to gender-affirming treatments. That's like puberty blockers or gender-affirming hormones. And yet in North Dakota, and this was horrifying, they are trying to they're trying to criminalize doctors who provide that. They're trying to fine people who are referring to themselves using transgender pronouns. One Republican senator said, that God gives you your identity and your sex at conception, and you shouldn't have any choice in that. When you hear that, what is that like?
Well, I mean, first I would say that the Republican probably needs to go and take a biology lesson, because sex is not decided at conception. It's decided quite a time after that.
Right.
Also, things that I've kind of been learning and through different science creators on TikTok again, is just that the binary doesn't exist anywhere. It doesn't exist in nature, really. Sex is not even binary, right? Like we think that there's, you know, the XY and the double X chromosomes and that's it, right? But that's actually not the case. And so, because if that were the case, then we wouldn't have anybody who was intersex. And you know, this idea that things are black or white, you know, boy or girl, male or female, is too simplistic. And and it doesn't actually really exist really out there. I would like to say that I'm surprised, because unfortunately, this is just kind of the way things have been going, especially in the States. I'm horrified, to say the least. I'm horrified the fact that we've let fascism, white supremacy, seek this much into our politics, both in the United States and in Canada. And it really just kind of does remind me about how far we have to come and how much we have to fight to protect what we do have. Because as we do know, we have a lot of influence that comes up from the states. We are very close to them, both geographically, but also within our media. And we don't, and in the states, they don't have the same sort of protections against spreading misinformation, especially disinformation. And so what really, when I hear that, it just makes me want to fight more. You know, it it can be really defeating, but I grew up very uniquely going to protest. You know, my mom used to work at the Village Clinic at the height of the AIDS epidemic. You know, so she provided healthcare to gay men who were positive with AIDS, HIV and AIDS, in the 80s and 90s. And so, you know, I grew up consistently being, you know, told that things aren't perfect, but we have to fight, right? And so I have that ability, you know, it was kind of bred to me in early on. And so when I hear that, I don't really feel defeated. I feel almost more inspired to like rise up and fight against that, because those, I find that that's not really how most people believe. Most people don't really care. Most people, it doesn't affect them if somebody, you know, goes by they, them pronouns or is married to somebody of, you know, same gender, or, you know, a lot of people don't really care. And
most of us are too focused on ourselves anyway, right?
Right? Like, it's, I don't, you know, I really don't have any time to care about who anybody else is sleeping with or how they identify, right? Like, it's, I've got a job, I've got a family, and I've got bills to pay, and, you know, all of these other things that it really does not come down to, like, and I also wonder, like, why this is taking up so much headspace.
Right.
For some people, because, like, I just, it really baffles me. Like,
it is baffling.
And so, but the thing is we are, fascism is on the rise.
Yes.
White supremacy is on the rise. And somehow we've, sometimes in Canada, feel like we're immune to it. And we kind of call ourselves the antithesis to the states, where we are not.
No.
And, you know, if you look at just even the governments across Canada and what's going on across Canada, and honestly, anecdotally, issues of homophobia and transphobia seem to be on the rise. And the willingness to fight it the same way doesn't seem to necessarily be there. And so it's just, because as schools and as divisions, we have a lot of power within our community. We could say, you know, whether we celebrate a Pride Day, and, you know, if people call in and say, just so happens that, like, you know, this might be against my religion, it is very easy just to like back off and then and cancel those things. But it is so much more to stand with the community, right? And so one of the best analogies, just kind of bringing it back to the NHL, is there was a guy who used to be on Sportsnet who was on a breakfast program, and he just ripped them a new one, right? They just like totally dug into the NHL and basically drew the parallel between if this had been a military appreciation night and somebody had refused to wear the jersey or do, you know, go to the puck drop or participate in any of it, the uproar that would happen in that. But for some reason, it's still okay to do that to queer folks. And so we just have to kind of ask ourselves is what type of world we want to live in.
And for our kids.
And for our kids, right? And so, and I really do think that there are more people out there who believe in human rights. And and unfortunately with social media, the few have seemed to have the loudest mics and be taking up a lot of the space. And so that's kind of how I try to get myself through the day to day.
Yeah.
And also knowing that, you know, there are really great people out there.
Yeah.
And for every, I don't know if you have to edit this out, but shitty politician.
No, that's good.
Okay. So for every shitty politician, there are multiple good ones. Yeah. And so nowhere, because now we politics are is no longer about ideologies. It's really about human rights. And really, no matter where you fall on the political spectrum, economically and things like that, really we have to start framing things and talking about human rights. Yeah. And so when we are taking away the human right of one group of people, we are really delving into something that, you know, is reminiscent of things of like Nazi Germany.
Yeah. Well, right? I was thinking that, like the fining of people. And I wanted to pick up on something you said with hope, and I know we got to get out of here in a minute, but it seems to me that you choose hope. Like you can hear this stuff from North Dakota and say, like, you know, everyone in the world is a bunch of assholes, or you can think like there are good people. And that inspires me, right? Because it's very easy to lose hope. I was wondering, you know, I'll talk to you after about what resources maybe folks in 2SL, LGBTQIA plus community who are teachers can use for support, and what people who are trying to be allies can use for support in terms of resources. But is there one thing you'd like to leave people with today as sort of a hope or a wish or just a comment?
I actively choose hope because despair is too much. And despair is very easy to fall under, because if all you have to do is turn on the news to feel that. And I guess I just draw on, I have a lot of really great people in my life growing up. My grandmother and my uncle, two of them, and they always acknowledged the hardships, but always really did push for striving for a better world, and that a better world is possible. And it's easy just to sit back and watch things happen. It's easy to sit back and to feel that despair, but in actively choosing hope, in actively showing up and taking up that space, I feel like I am just kind of honestly giving the middle finger to absolutely everybody. And I'm going to be happy. I'm going to be healthy. I'm going to be all of those things despite what they wish, right? So it's, they want to put me down. They want to make me feel small and insignificant, like I do not belong, but I refuse to put myself in that box. And sometimes I get a little, you know, pushed down and things like that, but there's always somebody there who has a hand to help me up. And I think that's what we really need to do, is we need to really go back and connect to community, help each other, hold each other up, and realize that a lot of the stuff that we hear on the news and on the media is not actually indicative of the people who we surround ourselves with. And I think the more that we connect to our communities, whether it's, you know, local communities, growing up, you know, in Winnipeg, it would have been the North End or the St. John's community specifically that I grew up in. In Souris, it's a small town, so there's, you know, a community there as well. And I think connecting with that and supporting people in your community, you really build that connection. And a really great movie, actually, just to kind of, that talks about this, is Pride. And it's a British film, and it's set in the 80s with Margaret Thatcher. And it was a group of gay men and a couple lesbians who heard about the hardships of the mining communities and what they were going through, and decided to show up for them and stand together in solidarity. And I really think that that's the biggest tool that we can have, is standing together and standing in solidarity, because if we keep showing up, if we keep getting back up, they will not continue to win. And just to kind of end this off with, is studies have just recently come out showing that millennials and Gen Zers are actually becoming more progressive the older that they get, unlike our Gen X and boomer counterparts, who got more conservative the older that they got. And so that also gives me hope. And just working with youth today is just like, when I tell them about the experiences I've had with homophobia and transphobia, it's just like they are flabbergasted that anybody would really care about that. And so that's what, it's the youth, it's my job, it's being with the kids in the building and things like that, that fill my cup to help me move forward. And it's for them, but also for me, that, and for my son and for my wife, that, and my nieces and my nephews and all for them that I know that I can get up and keep going.
Oh, love it. Thank you so much, Marley. And I'll remind folks to check our show notes, because I'll talk to Marley and we'll get some resources on there that you can look at. And thank you so much for your courage today and for you're one of the first members that's come on this podcast. So I really appreciate
that. I really appreciate, you know, you asking me to be here, and I love to talk. So, you know, it's, you know, being able to share my experiences, but also help people to maybe understand not just my experiences, but others who are out there who might be going through something similar. And that knowing that there are resources out there, and it's just kind of up to us to kind of tap into them sometimes.
Beauty. Love it. Okay, thank you.
Thank you.
Oh my goodness, that was incredible. Thank you so much to Marley Dewar for everything they said, and their courage and humility, right? To be in an equity-seeking group, and then also to have the humility to see how you are privileged. I really took a lot from that. And one thing I'm definitely going to walk away with is I'm going to start using my pronouns in everyday life when I introduce myself in person or on a phone call or whatever, because it actually saves lives. I don't think that's being hyperbolic. I think it really saves lives, because it's acknowledging folks that aren't usually seen, that they are seen. And to be seen is so important to mental health. I think when we don't feel seen, we know what we talked about. We talked about the suicidality piece there. So just incredible stuff. So thank you so much for listening. We love your feedback. Keep it coming. You can reach us by email, mbteachersunplugged@mbteach.org. or MB Teachers on Instagram and Twitter, and Manitoba Teachers on Facebook. You can find me on Twitter, Zed_Schnitzer, or on Facebook and Instagram, @ZachSchnitzer48. We want to know what resonates, what doesn't. So who do you want to see on the podcast? Do you want to come on the podcast? Is it too long? Is it too short? We want to hear, because we want to make it better for you, our amazing members. And thank you so much for listening. Remember to subscribe so you don't have another thing to remember to do. And tell all your colleagues and friends about this so we can truly build connection and create community. And finally, thank you for the incredible work you do, the miracles that happen every day in your classroom or your offices or your buildings. You are creating the future people of our society, and it's the most important work around. So thank you, and we'll see you next episode.